I've been asked by a few people to talk about the same thing I talked about yesterday morning. So those of you who might have been here yesterday morning and heard this, I apologize. It's not a sign, hopefully it's not a sign of senility to be repeating myself. The talk I gave yesterday morning was given before we did a special ceremony for Hilda Weisberg, who we honored as an elder in our community, kind of a wise woman, kind of a rite of passage for her. And it was marvelous to do it for her, because she is a wise person, elder, and someone who inspires us quite a bit in our community. But part of the context of the doing this for her is that she has ALS and declining very quickly. And she came for the event, and she came in a wheelchair with a headrest and could one arm's already paralyzed. And so, you know, it was a very powerful situation to be giving a talk in and preparing for her. She was there, and I don't know how often she'll be able to come back here again to hear talks. And it made me very aware that the teachings of the Buddha, Buddhism, were originally discovered and taught to help individuals face the deepest and most fundamental existential issues that everyone has to face, and things like sickness, old age, and death. And, you know, sometimes Buddhism is presented in very many different other kinds of contexts. It's not so uncommon in this country to have this practice of mindfulness presented as stress reduction. And that's kind of how it's presented, or as a technique to help you kind of manage more successfully at work, or to kind of be better integrated in life and get along better with your spouse or something. And all those mindfulness practice can help with all those things, but it can easily lose sight of the fact that as a religious tradition, Buddhism is really trying to address a kind of a solution to the dilemmas, the suffering, the challenges that things like death provides us. And I think some of you, probably most of you, maybe all of you, have had your encounter with death. Maybe not your own direct one, but you've known people who died, your parents or relatives or friends or neighbors or various people. And if you really get really close to those situations, it changes the context, changes your perspective on what's important. And many things that seemed quite important before the encounter with death now might seem petty, or seem less important or not important at all. And sometimes you even wonder, you know, what was I thinking, being so caught up and so obsessing about these things when, you know, when we're in contact with the immense fragility or the fragile immensity of our life. And you see a little bit this context for Buddhist teachings in kind of the catalyst for the Buddha to set off for his spiritual quest. Well, he was not the Buddha yet, he was Siddhartha. And it said that he led a protected life and didn't see much of really what his life was about. And when he was in his 20s, he for the first time encountered sickness, old age, and death in such a way that it really had an impact on him. And you know, that's not so uncommon for sometimes people in 20s, 30s, 40s, sometimes later, occasionally, where they really, these things have a real impact. Oh, this means me too? And so it said in Buddhism, Buddha's encounter with the sickness, old age, and death is his encounter with three of the four divine messengers. So it's kind of exalted in Buddhist tradition that he would encounter this, the kind of divine messengers that come to visit. And it gets his attention, and probably somewhat distressed or concerned or anxious about this encounter. But then he is visited by the fourth messenger, and he's out and about, and he sees a monk, a monastic, walking down the street. And there's something about the serenity and peace of that monk that also grabs his attention, kind of. And the contrast of the distress he felt seeing sickness, old age, and death is contrasted with him seeing the serenity and peacefulness of the monk. And that contrast kind of is the contrast of Buddhism. On one hand, you have the fundamental, the kind of distress, anxiety issues that people have around the fundamental existential issues. And then we have the possibility of discovering some degree of peace or freedom in relationship to it. So Buddhism is not alone in addressing these kinds of issues. Probably all major religions, all religions, in some way are trying to address what it means to be a human being, especially in the face of these big issues. People, when they encounter sickness, age, old, and death, they often go to religion for some explanation, some understanding. I mean, what's this life about? What's the meaning? Where's it going? How do I make sense of it? And so, as a religion, Buddhism does that as well. And I think it might be a little bit interesting to contrast Buddhism with Christianity, in that Christianity also is addressing these same issues in its way. But when it describes the life of the founder of Christianity, maybe the pivotal moment that's really important in the life of Jesus has to do with his crucifixion, his agony, his death, and his resurrection. What happened there around his death? And there's a lot of different Christian traditions interpret that event in a variety of different ways. But it's a way of kind of trying to make sense of the suffering, and some of the interpretations are quite beautiful in the kind of clear acceptance or recognition of all of our suffering, and somehow trying to find some way to resolve it or work with it or find our peace with it. But you have this image of this man on the cross, crucified in his agony, as a pivotal moment. In Buddhism, the pivotal moment in the founder's life is the Buddha sitting underneath a tree, not nailed to a tree, but sitting underneath a tree, sitting quite peacefully, and sitting actually with a fair amount of joy and well-being. And in this sitting up all night, and in this state of peace and well-being, having an experience, or having an insight, having an experience of release, where he experienced release from the forces of suffering, the forces of distress, the forces of fear, the forces of hate, the forces of ambition and greed in his own heart, was freed of those, and in being freed of those, found a solution or a liberation from the suffering of sickness, old age, and death. And in the Buddhist tradition, they say that when the Buddha became awakened, death no longer had a foothold in his mind. Actually, death, Mara, the force of death, could no longer find the Buddha. They could still find the Buddha in terms of, you know, his body, but they couldn't find his mind. Mara was kind of like a mind reader. And the mind of the Buddha couldn't be found anymore. There's no footing there. So this is a very important expression in Buddhism, the idea of having a footing or not having a footing. In modern English, we have buttons. We have words like buttons or hooks. That really got, you know, I had a, you know, it was really a hook for me, or that really pressed my buttons, or there was a resistance in me on this issue, or that really caught me, that experience. And there's some way in which experiences of life catch us. We get caught by it, or we catch it, and we grab on, or we resist it, or do something. And for some people, the experience of death or dying, in one way or other, is something that catches us, catches our attention in a big way. And something happened with the Buddha's enlightenment where death no longer caught him. So, you know, he still encountered death, and he walked around India, he lived for a long time still. But he, you know, somehow his mind was not caught by it. There was no buttons around death anymore. And it's been said, I've read many years ago, I read a study that said that they're studying different groups of people, people of different religious backgrounds and different things, and we're looking at people's relationship to death. And the conclusion of this study was that the two categories, two people who were most comfortable with death, least afraid of it, were people who meditated, didn't specify what kind of meditation, but just said people meditated, and people who had taken a lot of acid. So I don't know, you know, what that says about meditation exactly, but there's something about meditation that can help people cope with death or not be so afraid of death and approach it to much more maybe ease than normally they would. And I think this is a beautiful thing. And for some people, they're very, very motivated by this idea of how can they address and look at their death, their own death and death of others. So perhaps there's some freedom and some peace in relationship to it. So then, you know, the pivotal moment in the Buddha's life was the release that he experienced on the night of his enlightenment. His heart was released, his mind was released. He lived another some 45 years. And then at the age of 80 or 81, he died. And the story of how he died is also something that's preserved and remembered by Buddhists. And he died a peaceful death. It seems like he had a sense that death was coming. And it seems, as the story goes, he was walking back towards his home country in the foothills of the Himalayas. And he was walking across the plains of northern India, heading in that direction. But it seems that in his being frail and a lot of pain and being pretty sick at this point, he didn't make it all the way back. And where he ended up was a place that in the tradition described as kind of in the backwaters, some place that's not really anything. You know, it's kind of not a special place in any kind of way, just some country place. And he laid himself down between two sal trees, beautiful, majestic tree they have in India. And he laid himself down between the two of them in what's considered a dignified pose, on his right side with one hand underneath his right head. And he gave his last teaching. And the last thing he said was something like, everything is impermanent. He thought that was a really important thing to teach and say. Everything's impermanent. And given that, then practice diligently. Practice diligently. As they say in Zen, life and death is a great matter. Practice as if your hair is on fire. It's easy to practice as if, you know, that's later, I can do that later, you know, later. And some of you might be in the later school. You know, I'll get to it. But you came here today, it's nice, thank you. But, you know, I'll really get around to my real practice later. You know, and I've known people who later was, they were kind of shocked to realize that later was 35 years later. And they kind of, wow, I put it off that long? And he's made his last statement. And then he entered into meditation practice. And the experience of his death in meditation is kind of like, it's seen in Buddhism as kind of the culmination or the conclusion of the experience he had when he was enlightened, when he was 36 or so. And the release that he experienced with his enlightenment is brought to perfection or completion with his death. And what he did is he went through, he was a master meditator, and he went through what's called the eight absorptions, eight jhanas. He went through them progressively from one to eight, and then he got to eight, and he went backwards again, and back down to one. And these are very, very peaceful states of meditation, very rarefied some of them. Some of them have a lot of sense of well-being and joy as part of it, a lot of peace, a lot of equanimity. And then he went back to one, and then he started going up again. And it seems that people who've had gone through these experiences know them well. can kind of tune in, kind of feel that other people are going through them. So his attendants and which kind of could sense, oh yeah, he's not dead yet. He's going through these deep states of meditation. And then he came to the fourth absorption, which is a particular meditation state where there's a lot of peace and a lot of equanimity. The mind is very bright and very kind of luminous, very peaceful. There's no pleasure and no pain in that experience. It feels very, very satisfying. And in that experience, there was a final release. That was kind of like the culmination of the release that he experienced a long time ago. So to give you some sense of what this might be about, as the mind gets more peaceful in meditation, as it gets more concentrated, one of the things that begins happening is that we begin to let go. And we can start letting go of some of the obsessions that grab us. And some of these things are relatively easy to let go of. And some of the things are quite hard to let go of. But, you know, just like in the encounter with death, some of our petty concerns might be easy to let go of because we have a different context and they no longer seem important. So in the context of meditation, sometimes it's easy to see, oh, this is not really where I want to be obsessing, what I should be doing with my mind. And then kind of letting go of that obsession, that concern, that preoccupation. And letting go of preoccupation brings with it feeling of release or peace or calm. It's kind of calming effect on the system. And so part of the process of meditation is reevaluating where we want our mind to be, what we want our mind to be about, what we want to be concerned about in our minds. And if you're thinking about your taxes in November, you know, thinking about your taxes all the time, is that really what you want your mind to be about, what you want your mind to be involved in? And, maybe not such, you know, you're kind of maybe caught by it, or you're caught by trying to make more money, or caught by some relationship problem you're having, you're caught by, what to do with your car. All kinds of issues people get caught by. And at some point, there's a kind of evaluation that goes on in spiritual life about where you want your mind to be. And rather than let your mind kind of wander wherever your fears and distresses and greed might take you, there's a willingness of that, I don't want to go there. I'm going to let go of that, let go. But some things are not so easy to let go of. So another thing that happens in meditation, and that is that the things we're concerned about, or let's say it differently, our thinking might not disappear or stop, but our thinking gets thinner and thinner. It gets calmer and calmer, weaker and weaker. And so you might still be thinking about things, and maybe you haven't let go of thinking about your car or thinking about different things you might be concerned about. But the force of the thinking gets thinner and thinner and thinner, thins out. You know, it doesn't grab you quite as much. It doesn't seem so substantial, so big, so solid. I mean, probably some of you have had the sense of the different intensities by which you can think. And if you've never looked at your mind carefully, maybe you haven't even seen that, but I can imagine something big could have happened to you on the way here today. Maybe your car started smoking. And your car's never smoked before and started clunking as well. And you managed to get to a park, just in your parking spot, just nearby, just in time, before you thought the car was going to explode. But you got here great, and so you came in here meditate. And the intensity of your thinking around that car, what's going to go? Is it safe to drive home? How am I going to fix it? It's late at night. What am I going to do? Could be quite strong. And other times you might come here and meditate and nothing's really grabbed you. Nothing really important is happening in your life that really grabbed you in such a kind of big way. And so your thoughts are much more kind of floating, light, maybe pleasant even. But they're thinner. There's less energy. There's less intensity to them. They're more refined, more calmed. So as meditation deepens, one of the things that happens is the mind gets, the thinking gets thinner and thinner, weaker and weaker, more transparent, less substantial. There's less feeling of intensity. This is really important. At some point, there's a feeling of that thoughts are kind of like clouds in the sky. At first, the sky is maybe completely covered with clouds, thick, dark clouds. But slowly, as you meditate, the clouds begin to disperse and evaporate and disappear, and you start seeing the vastness of the great blue sky But there's still some clouds that are drifting in the sky. But you just kind of, you know, if you start seeing that the contrast of the great sky and the cloud. And you can't see that contrast when it's only clouds. It feels kind of depressed, depressing perhaps, and heavy. But you start seeing this all this space, and you still have thoughts, they arise, but you see the space between the thoughts. You see the vastness, the peace, the calm that's around it. And then there can be a very different relationship to our thoughts. If it's only, you know, dense clouds covering the whole sky, that's all you might know is clouds. But when you see the sky, then you have a different relationship to the thoughts. If you see there's a lot of peace and a lot of calm around your thinking, then there's a different relationship to your thoughts. And for one thing that might happen is you begin feeling that I don't have to pick that thought up. I don't have to get involved in that. I don't have to go into the fog and get wet. And so a thought might arise, you might have car thoughts, and say, oh, no thanks. And that car thought comes, it goes, and bye-bye. And there might be more powerful thoughts. There might be thoughts about your own death might arise, might bubble up. And maybe that, when you think about your own death, maybe that's a strong one, that's a strong cloud, that's a strong thought, and you jump on, you get on, you get involved. And then everything's clouded over again. Or you might, when the mind is very calm and peaceful and concentrated, you might see death thoughts arising in your mind, and you say, oh, I don't have to pick that up. I don't have to get involved in that. I can just let it float by and float out. Now, one of the reasons why you might want to do that is you might have a sense that as you get calmer and more peaceful, that there's a sense of vast presence, a sense of vast well-being or peace or stillness or luminosity, or clarity, or translucidity, or boundlessness, limitless kind of quality. There's a lot of different descriptions of this that is so much more satisfying, so much more meaningful, so much more precious than the thought that's drifting by. And you feel that actually you get diminished by going and getting wrapped up in that thought. You might think that thinking that thought is so important. And if I don't think that thought, you know, I'm going to lose the great American novel. And then I'll lose the Pulitzer Prize. And, you know, there's all these really important things. But all those things are just clouds. And they're important clouds. Clouds are important. But there's this vastness that's so satisfying, so peaceful, so wonderful, that's part of our nature, part of who we are. And you can kind of feel at some point, I don't need to go there. I don't want to go there. I have this better thing going on here. This beautiful thing happening, this vastness, this peace, this whatever. And so at some point there's a kind of a willingness to not pick up every thought that comes along. And that helps the process of thinning the thoughts out even more. Now it's really remarkable to begin realizing what thoughts are. I mean, some thoughts are verbal thoughts, some thoughts are images we have, or different ways people think. But so much, most of how people negotiate their life is through thinking, or thoughts, or concepts, or ideas. And our understanding of who we are, who the self is, who I am, turns out to a great degree to also be thoughts that arise. So I could be sitting here, meditating, and I could have a thought about myself. I could think, I am really the greatest Dharma teacher at this moment on the corner of Hopkins and Birch. You know, wow. You know, go out in the corner and look. You know, and whether it's true or not, it's a thought. It's one of those clouds. I can get into that cloud, get involved in it, dress myself in it, you know, try to convince you that's true, getting, you know, completely involved, or I can just see it as a cloud. Now, if I see it as a cloud and let that cloud just evaporate and go, that particular sense of self, of Gil as the great Dharma teacher, where is it? I could kind of dig up another cloud, perhaps, and make it appear again. But he's kind of vanished. So there are all kinds of ideas. You know, like if you're a parent, you know, maybe some of you are parents, or some of you are children, or some of you are have spouses, you're a spouse or something, or a partner or something. All those are kind of valid concepts. But in order to experience and know them, there's also, it's a cloud that arises in the mind, it's a concept, an idea. And we have to learn how to work and live with those concepts. We don't have to ignore them. But there's also the possibility in certain states of meditation, certain states, to just allow, see them as just kind of not who we really are. We don't have to see ourselves as a mother or a father or a spouse or a partner or as a, you know, worker or, you know, or as someone who's a successful person, an unsuccessful person, a worthy person, an unworthy person, a you know, great person, a lousy person. There's all these ideas we have about who we are. And people suffer a lot, awesome amount, by these ideas, these thoughts that arise. And even the thought, I am, innocent enough. I am, therefore I am. That's one response to, I think, therefore I am. I am, even that, in Buddhism, is seen as kind of a thought. You are. But to think that you are is a thought. So if you don't think that you are you? When a tree falls in the forest, is there a sound? When there's no thought that you're telling yourself who you are you? And but you have this great peace, this great vast, luminous transparency, this great sense of radiance that is there. And as soon as you say, oh, this is radiance, that's another cloud. So how do you enjoy it if you can't tell yourself a story about it? You know, and we want to tell ourselves a story about it. It has to be good for our ego. We have to be able to tell our friends, right, look at me, I have this radiance. But you can't do that if you kind of stay in the radiance because, you know, it's a thought that tells you, right? You following me enough? So there's a thinning out of thoughts happens. At some point, there's a realizing that maybe I don't have to get involved in this. And there's a willingness to kind of let go of them more. And the mind can get quite still when it lets go of thoughts. In Buddhism, sometimes it's called noble silence when the mind has stopped thinking. And stop thinking doesn't mean that we stop existing. But what's replaced by this wonderful presence, this wonderful awareness. And in some circles, this wonderful awareness is celebrated as what's ultimate. It's sometimes described as non-dual, because you can't have a self in that experience. As soon as you make a self, that experience in me, it's just another cloud that you've gotten caught up in. That's kind of self-reflection. It's just kind of this kind of a oneness of this great awareness. So there's a disappearing of self. There's this non-dual experience. And this makes some people conclude, this is who I really am. This is the true self. And when they come out and make a cloud, they say, oh, this is the true self. This wonderful, luminous, great experience of presence. However, in Buddhism, in a sense, takes liberation one step further. And that is the evaporating or dissolving, the falling away of even that wonderful, luminous presence. It's a release from that also. That also gets released. And it's very hard to describe this experience of Nibbana or Nirvana that happens when even that sense of presence, that sense of luminosity or equanimity or peace also kind of falls away or drops away or evaporates or dissolves or just, you know. But if you can imagine this great experience of peace that feels quite deeply satisfying, wonderful, nice. And it has a feeling of being boundless. You know, there's no boundaries to it. It just goes out and out. There's no center to it. There's no inside, no outside. It's just this great feeling of transparency, of peace. And maybe the sense of that peace is kind of going out. It's boundless, but it kind of just spreads out. It's kind of an experience of really everything's being released, being released, and being released. And it's so satisfying, so wonderful. And then the next step is that it releases itself. It just seems like so much natural next step for that to release itself. And when the Buddha died, And when he was in that fourth absorption, he was into this experience of peace and equanimity, and he let his consciousness, he let his mind do that final release. And in that final release, that is considered his ultimate or final liberation, called the parinibbana. What the Buddhist tradition then says is that what happens to a person upon death in that final release is cannot be described, cannot be talked about. You cannot make any logical statements about that person anymore. You cannot say that person is extinct, annihilated, is gone forever. You can't say that person is going to still exist in some way. You can't say the person doesn't exist. You can't say the person does exist. You can't say the person either exists or doesn't exist. You can't say anything about it. So it's very it's very irritating. because we want, you know, we want some kind of thing, some clarity. But the word nirvana is sometimes said to be to involve an extinguishing of a candle, extinguishing of a fire. And that can seem like annihilation. Why would I want to extinguish myself? But in ancient India or in ancient Buddhism, the understanding of when a fire gets extinguished, the heat doesn't disappear. The essence of the fire doesn't disappear, but just kind of gets reabsorbed, you know, heat, you know, conservation of heat, right? Thermodynamics, you know, the heat doesn't disappear into the universe, right? It's always there. So so the same thing, kind of like when the fire goes out, it doesn't really, the essence of it doesn't go out, but kind of just gets absorbed back in. So it's not very good Buddhist teaching to say, but it's close to, you could almost say it, but it's not very good Buddhist teaching to say, so I'll get criticized for saying this. But it's almost like at the death of someone who's enlightened, who has able to kind of do this release, it's kind of like the mind or the heart, the consciousness, goes home. But it's a home, you know, it doesn't do any good, but it's really glorious. It doesn't do any good because, you know, to have some kind of self-reflective idea that this is happening to me, it's just another thought, another cloud. And there's no more clouds. Does this make some sense? No way, huh? So, of course, there are other alternatives. There's a rebirth, there's being born in heaven, being born in hell. There's a lot of other alternatives that different religions will teach. The emphasis in Buddhism is, the ultimate emphasis is not rebirth, it's not heaven or hell, but rather is to bring the mind to this place where the mind can be at peace and release itself from all the things it's attached to. All things is holding on to. And so when the mind is that free, then there's no buttons on it. There's no hooks in it. And we're not afraid of death. We're not afraid of life. And then the mind becomes kind of like, I like the image of trying to take watercolors and paint on a flowing river. You know, it doesn't stick, right? The painting doesn't work. So there's, you know, life still flows, but nothing sticks. There's no Velcro. So a liberated mind, you know, is one mind where there's no hooks, no Velcro, no buttons. And one of the advantages of that is that then death has no foothold. There's no fear of death that happens. And I think one of the most beautiful things that I know, there's a lot of beautiful things, but one beautiful thing is those individuals who have the fortune to go through a process of dying peacefully, of being able, knowing how to let go. So one of the things that happens in Buddhism, when you're counseling someone, helping someone with the dying process, is often there's an emphasis to try to help the person to let go, let go. And sometimes you say that over and over again. It's okay to let go, let go. Everything's fine. Let go. You don't have to hold on. Everything's okay. Just kind of constantly, kind of encouraging them to let go. So they don't get frightened or angry or upset or distressed. You know, it often can happen at those kinds of junctures. But rather just kind of let go. Let the mind kind of... And it's kind of like can be almost like a natural deep meditation experience that happens as you're dying. So I think that's one of the reasons why meditators can be, adept meditators are less afraid of death, is because there's something about deep meditation that's akin, that's close to the experience of dying. And they've learned to work through a lot of the fear, willing to let go. So how is it that we deal with sickness, old age, and death? What is our choices? And there's many different religious ideas about how we address these kinds of issues. Some people don't care about religious ideas, but still, you know, sooner or later we have to encounter these. And so how do we do it with wisdom, with understanding, with gracefulness? How do we do it in a way that's helpful for others? I knew a woman who died a few years ago and died of cancer, and she had a 9-year-old daughter who she was very, you know, angry, upset about, you know, dying at this age of her daughter's life. But by the end of her life, she realized that that she was going to die. And she would do her daughter a tremendous favor if she could die peacefully rather than angrily or frighteningly. And she did. And it was a beautiful thing for her 9-year-old to see her mother dying quite peacefully, serenely. And it was a great gift, you know. So she was able to do something there that was actually helpful for others as well. So at the essence, for those people interested in it, Buddhism offers a practice and a path that leads us to deal with some of the deepest questions that a human being can have about their life, deepest issues in their human being's life. You can practice Buddhism and the practices of Buddhism without that concern, that interest. But I hope this talk this evening gives you some indication of kind of the heart of what Buddhism can do and can help us to do. I'll end with two poems. One is by the Chinese poet Li Po. You've heard a lot about skies and clouds. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountains and me, until only the mountain remains. And here's a poem by a Tibetan teacher named Lama Gendun Rinpoche. And it's a kind of thing that sometimes it's read to people as they're dying. There's a variety of readings that are sometimes read that are supposed to help with this process. And I don't know if this particular one is, but this is the kind of thing that sometimes is done. And it might be interesting for you to hear it. And then maybe imagine, you know, maybe not your deathbed, but imagine yourself at a time when you're not much is going on anymore for you. Not much you can do anymore. Imagine yourself, not much you can do anymore, but here you are. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already here in relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There is nothing to do. Whatever arises in the mind has no importance at all, because it has no reality whatsoever. Don't become attached to it. Don't pass judgment. Let the clouds happen on their own, springing up and falling back, without changing anything, and all will vanish and reappear without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It is like a rainbow which you run after without ever catching it. Although it does not exist, it has always been there and accompanies you every second. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They are like rainbows. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you relax this grasping, space is there. Open, inviting, and comfortable. So make use of it. All is yours already. Don't search any further. Don't go into the inextricable jungle looking for the elephant, who is already quietly at home. Nothing to do, nothing to force, nothing to want, and everything happens by itself. So part of the reason for me giving this talk tonight was because I gave the talk yesterday and the talk was not recorded. And one of the people who wants to hear this talk again is Hilda. As she prepares and as she goes. And it's my with my love and my respect for Hilda, I really would like her, as she goes through her stages now, transition, that she realizes that it's safe to let go. It's beautiful to let go. And this is not the time for her to hold on anymore. This is a time to let go. And someday, it'll be yours. So thank you.